traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Nancy Davis at Quadratic Capital, thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to talk to you about risk, the risks that are facing the markets. We hear a lot about recession risk here in the US. We hear about it just about every single day. We know about headline risk emanating from the Twitter account of a certain president. We know about earnings risk, of course. But on the bigger picture, systemic risk, and you have some views here that are a bit contrarian, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. So why don't you just start and talk us through that and where you see things right now.
It's a challenging time for investors today because you have risk assets near all-time highs, and then you also have government bonds in terms of prices with yields at all-time lows, and at the same time, credit spreads are near all-time tights. So if you look at kind of most investors' portfolio, it's some have real estate, but it's mostly stocks and bonds, and everything's expensive. And you could have said the exact same thing a year ago.
Everything's expensive,
but the market continues to see asset price inflation. So the Fed keeps talking about their inflation mandate, and the only thing that I see is asset price inflation these days. So it's a really challenging time for investors, and there are a lot of risks out there. And I think some of the risks are not just, people always talk about downside risks, but there's also upside risks because volatility can work both ways. And I think especially with so much of the market moving towards passive and rules-based and systematic, you can have the market move in big ways either direction.
Yeah, you gave us a lot to unpack right there. What would you say, maybe we'll start, what would you say are the biggest thing that the market's overlooking in terms of risk, in your opinion?
So I think we're at peak confidence for central banks being able to control markets. And I think there's a very, you know, a lot of people talk about things like confidence are not very tangible, but you can look at that by looking at the interest rate volatility markets. They're at very, very low levels in terms of absolute level as well as percentiles. And to me, that's a sign that we are in a very confident state for most investors, that central banks have control and that they're going to be able to, you know, soften any sort of crisis or risk event that happens out there. So I think that's kind of one of the most mispriced options markets out there in the world. And when people talk about volatility, most of the time people think of equity volatility, it's just one type of volatility. It's like saying, you know, just one color. You know, there are lots of different types of volatility markets. Equity vol, you can't really look at it and say, yeah, it's like, not that cheap, right? On a percentile basis or on an absolute level basis. Whereas other markets, also with options markets, so anytime there's an options market, there is by nature a volatility market. Other volatility markets, specifically interest rate volatility, to me look very attractively priced to own.
Right. So as you mentioned, every asset class has volatility. Every asset class that has options has volatility. And you were speaking specifically to interest rate volatility. How does one gauge that?
So you can look at, there are a couple indices out there. There are 4 main types of options markets in the US rate world. A lot of people are familiar with, obviously, Treasury options. That's a listed type of option, very transparent. Then there are Eurodollar options, which actually have nothing to do with Europe. They're the EDA contracts, for those of you with Bloomberg's. Those are listed options on three-month LIBOR. Mm. That's also a listed market. Then there are two OTC markets, the swaptions market, which is an option on the swap. And some people like to look at the move index, which is the annualized vol.
Right.
If you take the square root of 252 on that annualized number, you can compute the daily volatility that's priced in to the move index, which is around 5 right now. And then there's another type of volatility markets, which is what we access in our fixed income ETF iVol.
Right.
And that type of volatility is about 2 basis points a day. So if you look at the Treasury options market and the Eurodollar options market, it's way above 5,
like
5.5, 6, depending on what strike you pick. The move index is around 5 basis points a day. And the type of vol that we're owning, it's also interest rate options, is about 2 vol.
Okay, so a bunch of derivatives talk there, not all of which I can claim to understand, but the bottom line is that interest rate volatility is at all-time lows or at historic lows. How old are these markets?
So it depends on which market you're talking
about.
Right. They're all four of those markets are interest rate options markets.
Right.
Some of them vary in length from when swaptions started trading or when other types of options started trading. The options that we're talking about really started trading in the mid-90s, mm-hmm. like 1994.
Okay, so that's a pretty long history. That's 25 years, yeah. And what you're saying is that these are at, this is the lowest that they've been since when?
They're at lifetime lows.
Really? Wow, okay. So that speaks to, like you said, a lot of confidence that the central banks have this situation under control, which is a little bit funny when you consider all the news that's just come out in terms of repo repurchases and things like that. Is it repo repurchases or just repo purchases? By the way,
I guess you can call it what, like buying T-bills is not QE. What is it?
Well, no, hang on. None of this is QE. All
not
right?
QE.
Chairman Powell was very clear about that. Don't call it QE. But
so you can call it George. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's, the markets are definitely, I mean, think about where we were in December, right? Last year. So this is like not even a year ago. The rates market was priced for hikes.
That's right.
And think about how much the market has moved now being priced for so many cuts.
Right.
The amount of movement and expectations with really the Fed only cutting twice is just tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about, okay, what the market is actually pricing in terms of, you know, what is volatility? It's the distribution of returns. It's
the
distribution of outcomes.
Right.
That's mispriced, right? Just look at how much it's moved versus where we were in December before the Fed turned dovish.
Mm, indeed. So the question now is what, I mean, the Fed has basically said they are, if they do anything, well, no, they're going to cut, right? The next basis cut is all but telegraphed in. I believe futures markets have basically like 90%, 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, they've basically said that they are just going to keep things, keep rates low, right? Which would, I guess, mean that's why these instruments that you're talking about are so low. Is that right?
Well, they haven't said necessarily that. The market
yeah.
expects them to do that. So that's why I'd say the confidence of the market
right.
for the Fed to control financial products is extremely high,
mm-hmm.
which is why the volatility of having anything other than yields go down, you know, more
mm-hmm.
is priced cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot
mm-hmm.
of people don't expect anything to happen
mm-hmm.
other than
mm-hmm.
for them to continue to cut.
Right. And what if they embark on a real QE? Like, if they even come out and they say it's QE, or what if they do negative rates? That would cause a spike in these volatility instruments, wouldn't it?
It depends. I think it depends what's happening in other asset classes too.
Sure.
Volatility markets tend to become correlated with one another. So say, for instance, just to play out a kind of disaster node for most people's portfolios, say we do have a trade war. Say it's not with China. Say it's with Europe, for instance. You know, think about the election coming up and, you know, the middle of the country and car manufacturers and how popular it would be to maybe have a trade war after Brexit's resolved with the European countries. So just let's say we have a trade war with somebody. It doesn't matter who it is. And what does a trade war mean? That could mean higher prices to the U.S. consumer with the goods that we import, but not good inflation. That would be a stagflationary environment, right? Where you would have lower growth because people wouldn't be investing because they would be unclear what was going on, but you could have actual inflation. That would be sort of the, I'd say, super disaster node for most investors' portfolios.
Right, because once you have inflation in a real sense, then the Fed has to raise rates, right?
Yeah, I mean, the stagflation environment is higher prices, but lower growth.
Right.
And in that environment, the Fed really, what can they do? They can't be cutting rates when we have higher prices.
You bring up an interesting point here, which is a potential trade war with Europe. Us discussing disaster scenarios, there are obvious ones I don't even want to talk about on the geopolitical front. But in terms of financial, the China trade war obviously has gotten all the headlines. There was some skirmishes with Europe on the trade front earlier in the Trump administration. And you think that this is something that the market is, that's underpriced, I guess, the risk of it, right? So talk me through that. How could that work?
Well, I think we officially should make this the Halloween podcast.
Consider it
because
done.
October 31st is our Brexit date. So
unless it gets extended.
Unless it gets extended. Right. So most likely that is, I think, the reason that things have not escalated more with Europe is because of the risk of Brexit.
Sure, yeah.
Once that is resolved, whatever the resolution is, I think it opens the door to have discussions there.
Yeah.
And I think it would be politically very popular to...
Potentially, yeah. Yeah, right, because, you know, let's play this out. Well, at that point, you have a Boris Johnson-led UK, assuming that he stays in, outside of the EU. And then you have a German and France-led European Union without the UK that is, will then be doing its own thing. So one could certainly anticipate this. What other scenarios might lead to a spike in volatility on the interest rate front?
You know, obviously any sort of surprise to markets can lead to a spike in volatility. And I think that's the one thing about volatility,
right,
which is why you want to own it in your portfolio. Because if you can think of all the reasons ahead of time that the market is worried about volatility, usually you don't actually get volatility because everybody positions to cash. And we saw that with actually the Brexit vote, where people didn't think it was going to happen. The outcome was unexpected. We had a day and a half spike in volatility, and then it completely fell away.
Yeah.
So I think that's the case to really say you should have an allocation to volatility in your portfolio, because you're never going to predict what's going to happen. You have no idea what's going to move markets or when it's going to happen.
Right.
And so especially when people get very worried and there's fear around certain events, usually when it's all over the media and everybody's talking about it, it doesn't actually play out as expected. But I think, you know, going back to volatility being so low, one of the impacts that has happened since QE really started after the financial crisis is that asset prices have gone up and volatility in turn has gone down. And many investors have looked to ways to yield enhance their portfolios because government bonds are yielding so little. And it's caused a lot of volatility selling, a lot of convexity selling that's taking place in the market. Now, I'm sure the Fed didn't think we want volatility to go down and we want a bunch of people to speculate and write a bunch of options.
Right.
I'm sure that wasn't the intended, you know, desire or outcome, but well-meaning policy can have sort of very bad ramifications because of, you know, good intentions with, you know, outcomes that aren't necessarily expected.
Fair enough. Okay. Nancy Davis, I want to come back and ask you some more questions. Let's take a short break and pause right here.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else you find podcasts. Search for Contrarian Investor and Supply an Honest Rating. We want to hear from our listeners. Probably the most efficient way to submit feedback is through the Breaker app, available on the Apple App Store. If you prefer, you can email contrarianpod@gmail.com. You can follow us on social media as well, on Twitter @podcontrarian and on Instagram @contrarianpod. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program.
Welcome back, and I wanted to, on this show, we often look at when we have investors on, which is always, who else would we have on? We like to look at investors' background and what I like to describe as their origin story, what got them into investing in the first place. So maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about that, how you started, and what happened to where you find yourself now.
Yeah, so I joke sometimes that some women like to buy shoes, and I have no shoe fetish at all. I don't think shoes are very interesting, but I do love to buy options.
Okay.
And I started my career at Goldman. I was on the options desk, obviously, but even before I came to Goldman Sachs, I invested in options in college.
Wow.
And it's probably a little bit unusual and not what most people do, but I always was very drawn to looking at convexities, looking at statistics, looking at probability distributions and what was priced into skew, into term structure. And also I liked the risk management of structuring positions so that I had an asymmetric payoff if I was right directionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
But a limited downside if I was wrong.
Yeah.
And that's been consistent throughout my career, really, before I was at Goldman, when I was at Goldman, when I was a PM at Highbridge, as well as when I started my own firm in 2013 with Quadratic.
That's right. Cool. And now you have this new fund, new-ish, it launched this year, and I believe we can talk about it. It's an ETF, the IVOL, IVOL is the ticker. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, we really saw a need to give investors access to markets that they couldn't, you know, trade on their iPhone. That would be the way I would describe it.
Right.
Like anyone, a listed futures contract or a stock or a bond, anybody can trade that and have access to the market. But the market that we're accessing inside iVol is the over-the-counter interest rate options market. It's a government bond fund, so the majority of the portfolio is TIPS right now, so it's about 87% in TIPS, and then we have a interest rate volatility and inflation hedge on top of the government bond exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a long-only fund, long government bonds with the hedge.
Interesting, and this works to give investors access to interest rate volatility, long interest rate volatility.
Yeah, so the fund is long interest rate volatility, and it also owns options that are on inflation expectations.
Got it.
So we do well in a steeper environment for the yield curve, which happens two ways. One is a normalization of inflation expectations, because the yield curve is largely a result of investors' inflation expectations for the future. But also in a recession outcome or risk-off environment for equities and credit, that's typically when central banks like the Fed will cut rates. So we can do well in the rate-cutting environment with the increase in vol, government bonds are typically bid, and the Fed rate cuts happen, or in a risk-on environment where there's inflation expectations increasing. So it's similar to credit, where we have a spread between two different levels of rates, and we want those to move in one direction. Now, we're agnostic to the level of interest rates, whether they're zero, negative 10%, or 10%. What we want is steeper yield curves, increase in volatility, and lower yields for a bond exposure.
Got it. Okay, that's all very interesting. So what else keeps you up at night, Nancy? And I mean that proverbially, obviously. Things that you're concerned about when you look at risk in the markets or lack of risk. Is there anything else that the market has discounted right now and on the fear gauge, perhaps?
Yeah, I do think investors are not concerned enough about inflation. I know that's wildly unpopular to talk about because clearly demographics and technology and so many other things are pointing to deflation forever. Mm. But I do think it's one of investors' largest risks in their portfolio. And if you think about it, you know, you want to have your wealth for when you retire, but if things become more expensive, you could outlive your wealth. And I think especially with the, going back to the technology, there have been so many advancements in healthcare and, you know, long lives, which is a wonderful outcome. But at the same time, I think every investor, whether you're a deflationist or not, should have portfolio insurance in case there is inflation. And the inflation can be because of years of money printing. And, and you know, if you're a Fed watcher and you listen, one thing I've learned in my career is you don't want to fight central banks necessarily. Mm-hmm. And the Fed is saying we want to normalize inflation expectations. You know, the yield curve, in our opinion, is actually distorted because the Fed did Operation Twist in 2011, where they, you know, the U.S. Treasury yield curve 300 basis points of spread between front-dated yields and long-dated yields. When they did Twist, which is because they couldn't cut rates anymore, we were already at the zero bound. Europe was having, you know, on the brink of a crisis, and the Fed flattened the yield curve to stimulate the economy. I think that was the flattening of inflation expectations. And it's quite easy for the Fed to normalize that inflation expectations. And we think they've started doing that by buying T-bills.
Right.
Think about what buying T-bills is: moving the price of bonds higher in the front dated, moving yields lower to steepen the yield curve.
Right, but there's still the long end of the curve.
Still the long end of the curve. And I think that's another risk, is that most investors, you know, are using the Barclays Ag Index.
Right.
The Barclays Ag Index doesn't have tips or any kind of inflation protection in the portfolio. Okay. Actually, 26% of that index is actually short fixed income volatility because of the mortgage exposure. So a mortgage is inherently, you know, you as the homeowner can prepay the mortgage whenever you want. The owner of the mortgage as a financial asset has that short option exposure embedded. So I think the reality is people look at mortgages and think, oh, it's safe, but it's actually short volatility. And there is no inflation protection within that index. And so that's one of the problems I see with the passive benchmarking, is that even if you're not a passive investor, say you're an active investor, you still have a benchmark. And so people don't want to have things that are contrarian, like inflation, if they're not benchmarked to it.
Right. Indeed, yeah. And obviously the inflation does bad things to any fixed income portfolio, just about, right? So that's another reason to hedge. What do you make of one of the oldest inflation hedges, gold? Do you think that's effective?
No, I don't. I don't think, you know, some people look at oil, for instance, because it went up during a last period of inflation. I think that will not, you know, I'm not speculating on the price of oil, but I don't really think oil is an inflation hedge either. Just like I don't think gold is an inflation hedge. Gold is, in my opinion, its own beta. And it's wildly popular right now for investors to own as a safe haven. And I think just like going to back to my comments, when everybody expects something to be a safe haven, probably won't be.
Not to mention you don't get any yield, any dividend from owning gold. Or you've been around investors a lot. Are there any common mistakes that investors make that you've noticed?
So I think on the institutional side, a lot of investors see ETFs as passive index replication products. I think I was definitely in that camp, you know, a couple years ago as well, where I thought of ETFs as retail products that are, you know, replicating an index and for investors who can't access the index. And I think that's one thing that I've really evolved with and educated myself. iVol is actually an active ETF, and it's a very small percentage, but it's a actively managed commingled fund. So it's very similar to, say, a private fund that's commingled, except it's got the transparency with the active transparent of a separate account, because every day the holdings are disclosed. It has lower fees, typically, than other investment vehicles. And it also has intraday liquidity, and ETF ecosystem on top of the underlying asset. Mm-hmm. And so I think ETFs are generally kind of a misunderstood product on the institutional side. A lot of people look at separate accounts or private funds, but I think thinking more about strategy and less about the wrapper is something that I think is missing in the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, ETF is a 40 Act fund, just like a mutual fund.
Sure.
But they're not really in retirement accounts because they, from what I've heard, it's mostly operational, that they can't handle the intraday pricing that they're used to, just pricing once a day at NAV.
Interesting.
So I think, you know, learning more about kind of ETFs, active ETFs, and that movement, I think is something I would encourage investors to do.
Absolutely. And we will expect to see this industry continue to evolve as more people start more passive investment products of various kinds. And, you know, the various institutions trade them, right? I mean, a lot of these ETFs have options markets as well. So that's all very interesting. Okay, cool. Lastly, how can we find out more about you, Nancy, and about the IVOL ETF? Obviously, you just plug in IVOL into, you know, anything. But what about the firm Quadratic? Is there a website?
Yeah. So our fund website is www.ivolETF.com.
Okay.
And there's a link to our firm website as well from the fund website. So you have to have a separate fund website with the ETF versus our firm website, which is a longer web URL. It's quadraticllc.com.
Got it.
But we've, you know, we're definitely very open to talking to people and spreading the word about our new product that anyone can own.
Very cool. Are you on the social media?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I have LinkedIn, but I haven't really, you know, I don't have a Twitter account. I'm not on Facebook. So I think
maybe for the best. Though, speaking as somebody who has wasted a lot of time, not on Facebook, but certainly on Twitter. Although I also find it very useful for certain things. Anyway, that's all for today. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Nancy, for coming on. Happy Halloween, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on social media and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.